Thank you very much, Michael. Whenever I hear anyone saying you require no introduction, it reminds me of a friend of mine who was introducing Henry Kissinger. And he said, Henry Kissinger requires no introduction, Dr. Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger got up and he said, it's true, I require no introduction, but no one enjoys one as much as I do. I'll let you off, Michael. I think that when we are looking at international security and stability, the rule that applies above all else should be no surprises. The more predictable we are to one another, the less chance there is of an unpleasant and unwelcome shock to any part of the system of stability. Therefore, a great deal of what we intend to do, were we to win the next election, is to try to bring some stability and predictability to what we do in terms of defence policy. And the first thing that we will do on coming to office will be to institute immediately a strategic defence review, which we believe is hugely overdue. And we need to have it because we need to assess the current geopolitical threats and not simply allow ourselves to be where we were officially back in 1998, and because of the current effects on the budget of not producing a report in that time. We also then intend to introduce regular defence reviews, which will probably be on a four-yearly basis and put into legislation to try to take defence reviews out of the political cycle, again to improve predictability and to diminish the chances of political forces distorting what is happening. And I think that's to the benefit of both our armed forces in terms of planning and to the defence industry. But the problems that we're facing with the defence budget, and let me just start with that and I'll end with that as well. The problems with the defence budget in relation to the SDR are threefold. First of all, if you're using defence planning assumptions in your baseline for the replacement of equipment that are based on the tempo of 1998, you may find yourself having a very severe effect on the core budget and developing as a consequence of unfunded liabilities. Secondly, if we use UORs disproportionately to provide equipment for our armed forces rather than a properly planned procurement program, again, we're getting initial costs in the defence budget but not through life costs. Again, that has an impact on the core budget. And thirdly, the current arrangement between the Treasury and the MOD, where the costs of UORs above 900 million will be met 50% by the Treasury and 50% by the MOD, can result, as it has in the past year, in the situation where at 1.7 billion UORs, the MOD has to make a cutback of 400 million in its budget right at the outset, really before it starts to get anything else in the system, which forces the Ministry of Defence to make cuts in its core budget because it's getting more equipment to fight a war. Does seem to me not exactly an ideal way of funding what we're doing in terms of our military operations. So what do I perceive as the sort of threats that we might face? Well, I'm afraid that my view is that the strategic environment is deteriorating, not improving. At the end of the Cold War, everybody had an overly optimistic, as it turns out, view of what might happen in the world. And in medicine, we used to say the most useful instrument is a retrospectoscope, and that applies equally in politics. But we did not take fully into account, at the end of the Cold War, what the collapse of the Soviet Union might mean for nations where there had been 100 years of repressed nationalism, or parts of the globe where there was repression of religious fundamentalism, and what might happen if that pressure were suddenly removed. And we've seen to our cost some of the problems that have come as a consequence of that. People will say to me, if you're being frank, do you think that in Options for Change we took a too optimistic view of the world? I think in retrospect, yes, we did. And I think that was reflected right across the Western world for the very best of ideals, that people believed we were genuinely entering into a new world order, whereas in many places we've entered into a new world disorder and are dealing with the consequences. What are some of these areas? Well, Russia clearly is one of those examples. Russia now embarking on a $208 billion increase in its defence expenditure, largely funded by its petrodollars. By 2015, Russia will have provided another 4,000 tanks and APCs, 1,000 fixed-wing and rotary aircraft, a new submarine class, and by the time we get to our new nuclear deterrent here in Britain, at a lower warhead level than we currently have. We estimate that Russia will have added some 400 warheads to its land-based and 100 missiles, warheads to its submarine-based missiles. And that is not a positive development. When we look at what happened in Georgia, we can see that with the Medvedev doctrine of intervening wherever there are substantial numbers of Russian citizens is not a recipe for stability. And when you combine what we've seen in Georgia with other elements of what clearly is Russia's willingness to use oil and gas as instruments of foreign policy, but the movement into Georgia very quickly took control of oil and gas facilities and pipelines, and with the facilities that the Russians now have in terms of the bases in Georgia, in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, the ability to cut off Caspian oil and gas to the west within a matter of a couple of hours is now a very stark reality which we're going to have to live with. We also have seen in recent times Russia annexing or attempting to annex some 460,000 square miles of Arctic territory. We've got sea lanes now passing through what is disputed territory, the only major trading route that I can think of globally where that happens. We've seen a number of minor incidents where the Russian forces seem to be testing the Norwegians and others. And I think we simply have to understand that this may be an area where we may be probed from time to time by the Russians to test our resolve. Now, it's not an entirely negative picture, and I would hate you to come away with the impression that I'm entirely a Russophobe, but I think that what Russia requires is stability, it requires predictability, consistency and strength. And I think some of the messages that we've sent to Russia in recent years have been inconsistent. And I think that what we showed in Georgia lacked strength. And I think that we've not made as good a job in dealing with Russia diplomatically as we might have. That, however, in no way excuses what happened in Georgia. There was a very clear breach of international law. There was an unacceptable imposition of force, an attempt to destroy Georgian military infrastructure, and the situation of Russian forces on the sovereign territory of another state should, in my view, have got a sterner response from the West than ultimately it got. But great credit to President Sarkozy for the initiative, I think, that he showed in that. So Russia, one to watch. Iran is going to be an imminent problem. Now, I have colleagues who say, well, Iran is bound to become a nuclear weapon state. We better learn to live with it and accommodate it. And I profoundly disagree with that for three reasons. Firstly, the nature of the leadership in Iran, and when you have people like President Ahmadinejad, almost certainly reflecting the Supreme Leader Khamenei, when he talks about wanting to wipe Israel off the face of the map, rhetoric or not, that sort of language is unacceptable in a civilized family of nations. Secondly, Iran has shown itself par excellence to be a nation which will export instability and terrorism to neighboring states, and I don't really fancy Hamas and Hezbollah being able to add fissile material into that particular equation. I don't fancy seeing dirty bombs in Lebanon as a way forward for the region. Now, and even if you don't believe that either of those two reasons are sufficient to want to stop Iran's nuclear weapon ambitions, then I think if you think it through and Iran becomes a nuclear weapon state, then you're likely to have Egypt and Saudi and who knows what other countries in the region all wanting to become nuclear weapon states too. And surely we do not want to see another nuclear arms race with all its instability, expense and futility in the world's most unstable region. We surely want a better legacy for the next generation than that. And I think that's something that we will have to face up to. And I think that, again, there is a lack of understanding in dealing with Iran about Iran's internal politics. And I think that we've got to the phase now where, with Iran, we've invested so much in high-tech surveillance, we can read every number plate on every car in Iran by satellite, but we're not really sure who to talk to. on the ground. That is, if you've got anyone who speaks Farsi to talk to them in the first place. And we really do need to start, again, to question our priorities in terms of diplomatic policy and intelligence if we're going to get a stable environment in the longer term. And, of course, the third major threat that we face is Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda, for the sake of this discussion, I will use to describe a violent anti-Western form of Islamist fundamentalism. And I think that, again, we need to be very clear about what it is we're dealing with. And I think we need to recognize that there are those out there who dislike us because of what we do. They dislike us because of what's happening in Iraq, and they dislike America's closeness to Israel. But that is a group who can be dealt with, who can be negotiated with. There are those out there who hate us because of who we are. Our system of government, our values, our way of life, they are irreconcilable. And we have to accept that those people cannot be dealt with because they have chosen to confront us. We cannot avoid confrontation with them. Perhaps we can decide whether to confront them on the Afghan-Pakistan border or the Madrid train station or the London Underground or Manhattan, but confront them we will have to do. And I think that that requires us to have a moral strength of purpose that we need to rediscover in some parts of the Western world. And what about our actual deployments at the present time? Well, I was in Iraq 2 weeks ago. I was in Basra on exactly the same trip that I'd made just less than 2 years before, when we couldn't leave the armoured vehicles, we couldn't even get into the centre of the city, and when, as everyone knows, the casualty rates and fatality rates were very high. 2 weeks ago, first of all, we couldn't get into the centre of Basra because of the traffic jams, because of the number of people out shopping with their families. We went out walking in the waterfront without body armour, without helmets, chatting to ordinary Iraqis whose concerns had moved immediately away from security. All they worried about were their jobs, electricity supply and water supply in an utterly changed environment. And there's no doubt that what has happened in Iraq has been a major turnaround. And I say this with all sincerity, that it really does bother me that in our press, while there was acres of coverage of Iraq when things were going wrong, since things have started to get better, the coverage seems to have got less and less and less. And I think it's about time we had a bit of a debate about how we got to this beneficial position and where it might lead us from here. First of all, I think that enormous credit is due to the countries of the coalition who were willing to stick together through thick and thin and to see Iraq through to a better period. And I think General Petraeus deserves particular credit, not only for putting extra troops on the ground, but also recognising the political imperative to determine who are the reconcilables and who are the irreconcilables, and to differentiate between them and to have the political pragmatism and maturity to make that US policy. And one thing that I found very encouraging when I was in Basra 2 weeks ago was the fact that there, with the massive fiscal surplus which exists, and here we are in a credit crunch in the UK, and Iraq's talking about being unable to spend its $72 billion surplus quickly enough and wondering what it will do with its $90 to $100 billion surplus next year, you can see some of the real geopolitical benefits that a stable Iraq might bring. Down in Umm Qasr, they're now talking about building a new deep water facility, and given Iraq's potential railway infrastructure, it offers another means of transporting goods out of the Gulf without going through the Straits of Hormuz. It could go straight north onto the Mediterranean in Turkey, which of course makes Turkey a much more important player than many people have given Turkey credit for, although I think that in the United Kingdom, both our government and opposition should be applauded for the way in which they have stuck by Turkey and supported it when many of our European partners have not. So I think there are potential benefits that a stable Iraq can bring us in terms of our security. But Afghanistan, I'm afraid, is an area where there are still a substantial number of question marks about exactly what it is we're trying to achieve. And if I may just say something political before I deal with that, I think it's this, that we in Britain are a liberal democracy, but we were liberal long before we were democratic. We had 150 years between Adam Smith and universal suffrage. We abolished slavery 100 years before we gave women the vote. We never extended our franchise if it affected our political or economic stability. And we're unable to create Jeffersonian democracies in 13th century broken states in 5 or 10 years. We need to have an understanding of our own history to understand what we are likely to be able to do in any predictable timescale. We also have to get out of our heads this idea that democracy is simply the exercise of electromechanics. If democracy was simply the exercise of electromechanics, Gaza would be the beacon state in the Middle East. Democracy requires to sit upon the pillars of a rule of law that applies equally to the governing and the governed, a concept of economic rights in a free market system, and a concept of human rights applying equally irrespective of gender or race or religion. And we're therefore, I say this because we need to have not just noble purposes, but realistic timescales in what we're trying to do in countries like Afghanistan. This is going to be a long-term project, because to provide the institutional underpinning for the democracy that we intend to see developed there will take us time. And we need to ensure that we are operating in a way where not only our own departments in Britain, the FCO, MOD and DFID, are operating in a very clear and concerted way in the areas where we have responsibility, but also that the international community is operating in a properly coherent way, and that we're all operating to the same strategy. Someone, when I last visited there, said, you know, the one thing we're not short of are strategies. You know, we've got an EU strategy, an Afghan government strategy, a NATO strategy, a UN strategy, a British strategy. You can take your pick which strategy you want. Ultimately, however, we need to have a very single and clear view internationally of what it is we're trying to do, and to make sure that our military and reconstruction efforts are far better aligned than they have been in recent times. That's the only way that, we can hope to bring stability to Afghanistan. And as for NATO, inside Afghanistan, well, we need to, I think, understand that this may well be an existential problem for NATO. If NATO cannot be made to operate in Afghanistan, why would it have credibility and cohesion for the future? Therefore, I think it's essential that we find ways of ironing out some of the problems we have in Afghanistan. And in particular, if I can mention just one, I would say that we have a problem with the basic funding mechanism in NATO, which has been made very clear in Afghanistan, and that is effectively that those who do the fighting also do the funding. So the more troops we have, the more equipment we have, the higher the bill gets to that national government. And I think it's pretty unacceptable to British, Canadian and American taxpayers in the longer term that we should be providing not only the higher risk to our military by their physical deployment, but also a higher cost to our taxpayers because we're willing to make that military deployment. And David Cameron, in his Chatham House speech, suggested that we need now to look at a mechanism within NATO for missions that we carry out beyond Europe's borders, create a real fund so that the countries that take part are actually reimbursed for that, not least because it removes a barrier to some of the smaller countries where, for financial reasons, they feel they cannot take part at the present time, and the alliance is weaker for that. It's something that we need to look at. It's something we've already had discussions in Washington and Ottawa and Ankara and beyond on. Michael mentioned the military covenant. None of this is possible. None of anything that I've mentioned is possible unless we have the armed forces to actually carry out the policy. For 5 years, I worked as a civilian with the army, as an army doctor. It was, of course, the perfect relationship. I had the honorary rank of major, which meant anyone below me had to do what I told them, and anyone above me, I just said I'm a civilian. Sadly, it's not a luxury that very many people have in the forces. But at that time, I really worried about some of the welfare issues that affected service families. And I think the bottom line is this. If you want to create unhappy service personnel, the easiest way to do it is to create unhappy service families. And there are a number of reasons why we have unhappy service families. The rate of deployments, the frequency of deployments, the gaps between deployments, mean that families are separated more than they were before. That has an inevitable strain. The standard of accommodation has been much commented upon. the educational attainment for service children, the way in which the NHS takes no account of people moving around from one base to another, so that if you're on an NHS waiting list in one part of the country and are required to move by the government to another place for part of national security, you drop to the bottom of the NHS waiting list somewhere else. Now, that is nothing to do with money, that's simply to do with bureaucracy, and it should be easily sorted. If we can make sure that when we are making arrangements in how we provide welfare services of one form or another, that we take into account the armed forces. Another example would be that for local authority funding, if you've got a population of travellers that comes and goes, you will get a grant to take account of that. But if you've got service children who come and go in number, you don't get a grant to take account of that. There's something very wrong in a culture that allows that to happen. And that simply is about awareness in Whitehall of the pressures that affect the armed forces and their families. And we will produce at the next general election for the first time a separate armed forces manifesto which will deal with welfare issues relating to the armed forces, which will deal with some of the issues I've already mentioned, and which will deal with procurement plans and our outline on that, because I think that we need to give a reassurance to the armed forces and their families that they are not forgotten. Because unless we can do that, unless we can diminish the unhappiness that exists inside service families, we will continue with the problems of retention that we face at the present time. And simply reducing our forces in Iraq will not be enough to diminish the level of overstretch that we face at the present time. We need to keep the people in the armed forces that we have. We're losing too much of the quality that we have trained and given experience to over the period. Finally, I want to, before we enter into a debate, just say a word or two about procurement. I said at the outset that we wanted to give greater predictability to the defence industry, and I think that's very important, that they are not operating in an ad hoc environment. So the aims of conservative procurement policy will be, first of all, to give our armed forces what they need when they need it, at a reasonable cost to the taxpayer. That must be right, and it must always be number one. Secondly, as I say, to give better predictability to industry in terms of what we're likely to want to procure as a consequence of what we have perceived in our regular defence reviews. And thirdly, to help defend British defence jobs by seeking, as an element of policy, to want to increase Britain's share of the international defence market by supporting defence exports, which will mean reinstating DSO right back inside the Ministry of Defence and not treating defence exports like we're exporting paper clips or candles. Defence exports are an integral part of security policy, and it's only right that that is operated from within inside the MOD as part of a national security strategy, the structure of which we will also want to alter. And we'll have five tests, as I've laid out before, for any procurement project: capability, affordability, adaptability, interoperability, and exportability. And these are tests which really should be met as part of giving the taxpayer value for money, and also both for predictability and the strength of exports. And in all of that, it doesn't mean that we're going to be rushing off to the US to buy everything off the shelf, or rushing outside the UK. In fact, we see very strong benefits in intergovernmental partnerships. We see strong benefits in us cooperating with the United States because of its economy of scale and the size of its defence infrastructure, but also cooperating with partners in Europe, perhaps even beyond, where we believe it to be in our mutual interest to do so. But one thing I would make very clear to you: we are talking about intergovernmental policy. We're talking about dealing at a nation-to-nation basis, not a supranational basis, which is why we will not allow procurement policy to fall under the auspices of the European Union. We believe that it has to be independent, that the United Kingdom has to have control over what happens in terms of our procurement. And while we'll be willing to cooperate with many other countries that we think may have an ability to give extra bang for the buck or capability to what we want, and it will not be a little Englander policy, but it has to be a policy over which we have control. and therefore we cannot surrender any elements of that procurement policy to the European Union. And we have made that very clear to our partners. The very final thing I'll say is this. Will the Conservatives increase the defence budget? Well, if anybody in this room can tell me 2 hours from now what the international financial environment will look like, I'd be pretty surprised. Never mind what it might look like 18 months from now. And so the most ridiculous thing that anyone could possibly do now is to stand up and say, I know what the size of our public expenditure programme will be in 2 years' time, and I'll give you a figure. That would be quite crass, and if we've got to get away from anything in British politics, it's promising things that we cannot deliver. There's not been a defence secretary or a shadow defence secretary probably since the war who wouldn't have liked a bigger budget. But as my father used to say, like doesn't always get. And we will have to wait to see what the state of public finances are at the time we come to government, and then make a judgment accordingly in terms of the priorities that we will have. To do anything else, I think, would be quite wrong, quite misleading to our armed forces, to our defence industry, and to the people of this country, and we will not do it. Thank you very much.